Very good. Very good. Here again. I started listening to Ajahn-Mayama. If appropriate, would you share some lovely or insightful stories that you learned from her? Thank you. Yes, she, for those of you who went over to Dhammasala, that she started off over there for 2 years. She was living in a caravan, really hot. But, you know, she just stuck it out. Really, really tough nun. So she's over there, but she did get some, she doesn't know, some sort of self-degeneration, don't know what it was. But anyway, that she, she's fine. Every now and again, that we give her a call. So she can understand everything. She's doing well. So even though on the outside, sometimes people, they can't talk very much, but I know that she's not that sick because she can laugh at my jokes. So that's the sign of a higher brain function. So that's, she's a good nun. She was over in Sri Lanka for a long time, I think with Ayakema. Ayakema story. It's one of the reasons why the monks or nuns should never go anywhere near gambling. Because Ayakema, she was teaching a retreat over in England, and on the way back, after the retreat had finished, she was being taken over to Heathrow, and on the way she had to get lunch before noon. So they stopped at one of these places, which was half a pub and half a restaurant. So to be able to get to the restaurant, you had to go just through the front of the pub. And so, you know, they had a nice meal there. It was, you know, all okay, nothing sort of dodgy about, just having to walk a little bit through the front of the pub. But then afterwards, she'd finished her meal, or she was actually just finishing off, and her driver, she still had some English coins left, and they were coming back to, I think, Germany or to Australia, I forget which, but they had some English coins left, and it wasn't enough, you know, to exchange at the airport, and they were just heavy. So the attendant noticed just at the entrance, you know, you come out of the restaurant, and then just the front of the pub, they had one of these. They call them, where I grew up, one-armed bandits, you know, the poker machine, the I don't know what you call them, wherever you come from, but, you know, you pull the slot machine, yeah. You pull the handle, and then these things go round, and you get stars or bowls or something. And you just know, she just did that to get rid of a bit of money. And she just put a pound coin or £2 coin in the slot when the nun came past. And she said, Aya, now you have much better karma than I have. You pull the handle. And in a moment of, like, you know, a lack of restraint, oh, why not, she pulled the handle. You know what happened? Went round and round and round. And this is no exaggeration. Jackpot. And this nun, she was there in her robe, and all this money poured out onto her robe, not supposed to touch it, but it just came onto her. Pounds and pounds just pouring out. And this was in the pub. And everybody went quiet. The whole, you know, people there put down their drinks. And the barman, he had a little bell. Ding, 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 ding. And he said, he announced to the nun, he said, it is the custom, you know how English like their customs. It is the custom, our tradition, whoever wins the jackpot has to buy a round of drinks to everyone in the bar at the time. So it was one of the first times that a Buddhist nun wore gin and tonics and double whiskies, rum and coke, whatever it was. She had to buy it for them. She had no choice. So The moral of that story is that just don't ever do that, any monks or nuns, because you may think, oh, she's pulling a lever, but you've got the good karma. Oh, you get in big trouble afterwards. So that was Ajahn Weyama's teacher. Dear Ajahn Brahm, as human beings, can we as individuals ever earn anything? Earn anything? As a human being, can we as individual ever say we are better or worse than some other individuals? You can say that. You're not right, but you can say whatever you want. Call free speech. Actually, it's too much free speech these days. So I think we should put a tax on speech. Imagine we put a tax on speech. And every time you spoke, you know, it'd be like a dollar in the donation box. And that would mean we'd make a fortune in this place. I'd have to pay the most. But no. Can we ever earn anything? Oh, you do your karma. I think I'm not quite sure exactly what you mean there. But yeah, you're owner of your karma, so you can earn something. Right. Can you say better or worse than some other individuals? Oh, really, you can't really say you're better or you're worse. You can't even say you're the same, which is different, that's all. There are trees in the forest. Which tree is the best tree in the forest? Which is whichever one you like. If we as individuals cannot make the judgment, paragraph 2 above, can we, some other entity, make this judgment? Who is the best and who is the worst? No, those entities, they make those judgments, but they're not really right. Is this judgment relevant or not sensible? Absolutely not. Because how can you judge anybody? You have to know their mind, know why they do things, and why they had to do this, and sometimes you just don't know. So I always say, give people the benefit of the doubt. You don't know why a person banged the door. They probably banged the door to warn you there was a snake coming. You don't know why they shouted at you. Maybe they did that just to test you out, to see if you were enlightened. You don't know why people do these sort of things, so you just leave them alone. So don't judge. If the breath disappeared at around the pity stage, how come the sutta still says breathing in and out at such stage of the latter? Because you're still breathing. It's just you're not focusing on the breath, you're just focusing on the pity and sukha. And what it actually is, a wonderful way of looking at this, when you're first breathing in and breathing out, you are noticing that through the fifth sense door of physical touch. Now, later on, you're noticing this in the sense door from the mind. It's the mind what looks at it and gives it the happiness. So it's actually looking through it from a different sense door. So you are still breathing in and out, but you're noticing the breath through a different sense door, and also at the same time, you know, it's a citta sankhara, the pity and sukha, made from the mind. It's your mind is actually adding on the joy, and that is what is most important there. So you are still breathing in and out, so this is a case that you're breathing in and out, but you're not focusing on, you're experiencing the pity, experiencing the joy as you're breathing in, as you're breathing out. But you're not focusing, your object is not the pity sukha. What if our meditation, we have this paritta chanting in our mind? Oh, that paritta chanting, it's like a protection chanting, and it really depends what you're trying to sort of chant or why you're trying to chant it for. Sometimes the paritta chanting, we use it to scare away ghosts, because especially my chanting is so bad, no self-respecting ghost would come close to me when I'm doing my paritta chanting. No, it's not like that. Sometimes I don't know why you have the Purita chanting in your mind. It's just maybe a habit. And sometimes if it's a habit, it means you're doing too much Purita chanting. So one thing you can do, if you've got chanting in your mind and you want to sort of try and go past that and have some more peace, then slow down the chanting. Iti pi so bhagava. Then you're peaceful. Slow it down. You have said, that life is like a moving car without a driver. Did I say that? I'll not admit that until I see my lawyer. You've got to be very careful what you say. There was another nun story. Nothing about nuns, it just happened with a nun. That sometimes what senior monks or senior nuns say, people just follow, without even thinking about it. So this was also in England, nothing to do with this nun, another nun story. And the nun, a senior nun, was again being driven to Heathrow in the car, and the driver was asking for directions. And so the senior nun said, straight ahead at the roundabout. So the driver had so much faith in this nun that that's what she did. When she came to the roundabout, she went straight over the top, over the middle, down the other side. Straight ahead of the roundabout. It actually happened. So yes, it's good to take advice from wise teachers, but please understand what they mean. You don't say, I'll go straight ahead at the red light. No, when it turns to green, then you can go straight ahead. A moving car without a driver, if it has its own course and not influenced by our own will, then what is the effect of our spiritual practice on the life course? Changing the course or stopping the natural course by stepping on the brake? Thank you. Oh, there's so much stuff going on there. It was a metaphor to actually use when you are meditating. In other words, when you're sitting down nice and peaceful. Imagine that your body is just like a car without a driver. Take your hand off the steering wheel, the feet off the pedals, and just let go. That's what that metaphor was for, was that it's scary at first. I'll crash! Things will go wrong. But just try it when you're meditating. Stop driving the car, take your feet off the brakes, just see what happens. Because the momentum is good enough, and after a while, because you're not doing anything, just looking out the window, as it were, being mindful, not interfering, and then it slows down and becomes quite peaceful. So it's okay to do that letting go, but as I said, please don't let go when you're on the motorbike in the middle of the traffic. That's where you've got to hang on. And sometimes, again, the same as that story about the nun, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And you give me a lift back to Bodhinyana Monastery tonight or something, and you say, oh yes, Ajahn Brahm, I remember what you said. Take your hand off the steering wheel, get off the pedal. Put it back on the steering wheel quick, it's going to crash. You've got to use it at the right time, the right place. So that sometimes you're giving instructions and sometimes people don't understand it. There was the story of the... this was one of the Nasruddin stories, the Sufi stories. And this young man, Nasruddin, he was in the salt trade. So he would put the salt on the donkeys and he would travel from place to place selling the salt where they needed it, buying it in other places where it was cheap. And he was making quite a nice living. But he had his son, his teenage son, would help him. But every now and again they went across these narrow bridges. And if the donkey wasn't evenly loaded with the salt bags on either side, sometimes it was dangerous for the donkey. So if the father saw the donkey leaning to the right, he'd tell his son to push the donkey further to the right. Push the son, because the son was a teenager. Whatever the father said, he would always do the opposite. And that way, he managed to get the donkeys over these narrow bridges without ever losing any salt. The donkey was leaning too far to the left, push it over to the left, son. And then he'll push it to the right, to balance. And then one day, he was going over a narrow bridge, the salt was leaning to the right, so he said, "As usual, our son, can you push it further to the right, please?" And the son pushed it further to the right, and the donkey fell in the river. "What did you do that for, son?" "Dad, don't you remember? It's my birthday today. I'm 20. I'm no longer a teenager." And that was 12th to 13th century Iran. Amazing. Okay. As a layperson, we really do not have enough time to make advancement, let alone enlightenment. Who said you have a whole lifetime to get enlightened? Having said so, I managed to sit for almost an hour each in the morning and in the evening. Yay! Now I'm thinking to spend more time on the weekend to read sutra or studying the language of Pali. Yay! What should I do first, reading sutra or learning Pali? So, what you should do last is deciding. Just do it. And reading sutra or learning Pali, meditate first. That's even better. I haven't said yet. You know when the best time to meditate is? When's the worst time? Exactly. Please tell me how not to be mindful. I mean, not to force myself to be mindful. I've been saying that for the last 8 days. Oh. Tell me how not to be mindful. I mean, not to force myself to be mindful. Yeah. Mindfulness is natural. Okay. Ajahn Chah's story. A Swedish professor came to see Ajahn Chah. Oh, it must be about 14 years ago now, at least, because I was there at the time. So, a professor. He was commissioned by the government of Sweden, so he had a diplomatic passport. So, you know, he was looked after by the local governor in Ubon and taken to Ajahn Chah's monastery. You know, this is an important person. And then, you know, he was an interpreter, welcome to a monastery, said Ajahn Chah, "Well, how can I help you?" And he said, "I've been commissioned by the Swedish government to do," he was a professor of psychology and philosophy, I think, "to research meditation." This was a long time ago. The Swedish government was always really advanced and said, "It's important, we want to understand, what is meditation?" He said, "Because I'm from a big university in Sweden, and the way we do things, to do research, we have to ask the same questions, you know, to make so we can compare it. So, it's systematically, we have four questions, and I've gone around to answer every guru in India, and in the Lama in the Himalayas, teacher, Swami, everybody who's knows anything about meditation. Now I've come to Thailand, and I hear that you know about meditation, Ajahn Chah, so can you kindly answer these four questions for me? So I can take them back to my government and compare with what all these other famous teachers would say." So Ajahn Chah, okay. And so he heard the questions. And the questions were, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? Number two. Number three, how do you meditate? And number four, what do you get out of meditation? He said, "I've asked those four questions to lots of other great teachers, now up to you." Now, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? What do you get out of it? And so Ajahn Chah, it's important. So he asked for a piece of paper and a pencil. Straight away we knew Ajahn Chah was up to one of his tricks again. And it couldn't wait, because it wasn't getting bigger. It was really entertaining. You never ask for a piece of paper. And then, I don't know where he's seen this, maybe he's seen the Westerners. He took the pencil, licked through the candle, scratched his head. He was an actor. He was a comedian. And so then, he thought, scratched his head, and he wrote it down. One. Or something like that. And when he finished answering the questions, obviously in Thai, didn't write English, then he gave it to the translator. And the translator laughed, obviously, when he got himself together. He asked the translator, he answered the professor, "Professor, this is my master, Ajahn Chah. The answer to your first question is, what is meditation?" His answer is, it translates as, "What is eating?" Your second question, "Why do you meditate?" His answer is, "Why do you eat?" Third question, "How do you meditate?" You got it, "How do you eat?" And the fourth question, "What do you get out of meditation?" "What do you get out of eating?" And Ajahn Chah looked at him and smiled, and the professor got really angry. "I can't take answers like that. This is not a joke. I'm going to take this back to my professors and my government." And I said, "That's all you're getting." Ajahn Chah was very stubborn. And they were brilliant answers. Meditation. Being mindful. Being peaceful. Letting go. Being still. I don't know what is. Peace, mindfulness, what is it? Why? Did anyone ever teach you what is eating? Did they teach you how to eat? Teach you why you eat? What you get out of eating? There's some things that when we learn about them, they get really complicated. We just do it, it's actually quite simple. Sit here and just relax to the max. Sometimes I feel like a bit of a fraud. What I've been doing, telling you, is to relax to the max. Don't you know how to do that? Should be the most simple thing in the world. Just do nothing. That's what we're supposed to do, meditators. Just relax to the max. Just do nothing. So there was the monk. And he received a call one afternoon. It was from one of his chief supporters. And he said, "Oh, I'm glad I got through to you. I need you to come to my house to do some ceremony, some chanting." And the monk replied, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm busy today." "So what are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm doing nothing today." That's important, that monks do nothing instead of just rushing around and like everybody else. This is my doing nothing day today. So I'm doing nothing. And then the caller thought, "Oh, at last someone who practices what they preaches." You know, they teach other people to relax to the max and the venerable is to relax into the max today. He said, "Well done, congratulations, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." And the caller hung up the phone. And then next day he called again, got through to the same monk. "Oh, it's you again, great. Now look, today I really need you to come and do this ceremony in my house." He said, "I'm sorry, I'm busy." "So what are you doing today?" "That's what you said yesterday." "So today I'm doing nothing." "But that's what you said yesterday." "Yes," said the monk, "I'm not finished yet." So he gave that priority. So instead of getting all these other things, you know, give them priority, giving relaxing to the max priority. Put that number one in your list, the things to do. And so when people ask you, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, that's a trouble these days. They say I'm doing nothing." "Oh great, can you help me?" They just don't value, they don't give any importance to doing nothing. They think if you're doing nothing, you can be free to help somebody else. No, it's important. So, you know, say, "Can you help me?" No, you help me do nothing. Get that out of the way first. Actually, monastery life versus military life. Both have rules and instructions to follow. Which is the easier life? Oh, come on. Which life can you tell jokes? In the military? Can you tell a joke in the military? Oh, you just get in big trouble. So, monastery life, both have rules. But the goal, if it's a goal, of monastery life is to relax, be peaceful, be a good example. Military life is to control. That's why that sometimes I remember just noticing when I was in UK, all these establishments, Ministry of Defence. And I said, that's not Ministry of Defence, it's the Ministry of Attack. They're always attacking people. Well, anyway. Ooh. Dear Ajahn, I'm curious about your learning with Ajahn Chah. Did you know the language of Thai when you first arrived in Thailand? Or there was a translator for foreigners? Or do you think of language barriers matters? Oh, here's Ajahn Chah's favourite saying. This was to Dr. Sanjay Tamasaki. He was an ex-prime minister, and he was also the head of the Privy Council. So he's a very important person. So Ajahn, Dr. Sanjay Tamasaki, he came up to see Ajahn Chah, and he asked the same question. How come you got so many Westerners? Can you speak English? And I said, no, can't speak English. So how do you teach these Westerners? And he said, it's so easy to teach Westerners. It's just like teaching water buffalo in a village. You just put them this way, give them a kick until they can do the job. So he didn't teach through words. You know, he teached through his beautiful actions, just like I said. How heavy is the stick? Throw it away. It's only heavy when you hold it. Really, it's sort of very simple teachings. What is meditation? What is eating? Such very simple teachings, but very profound. I would like to know when the mind is still, will the empathetic power, that is the power of better understanding others, be empowered? Of course it will, because when you understand yourself, that's when you understand others. If you're going to, say, be a car mechanic, many people learn about cars by just getting an old car and taking it apart. You know, I remember as a kid taking a radio apart, couldn't put it back together again. But that's how you discover things, by trying, get your hands dirty, finding out how it works. That's how I said about building brick walls, doing plumbing, you just get in there, give it a try, and see what happens. And so, when you start to understand yourself, how do you understand yourself? Just watch yourself, mindful, aware, find out how you work. Your peaceometer. What makes me peaceful? What makes me agitated? It's not looking at books and figuring out what other people say. Just, I feel I'm getting peaceful now. I feel I'm getting agitated. Why? That's where we learn. And then when we learn what works for you, you find that works for others. You know, I look at myself, you don't judge the poor old Ajahn Brahm, just tell terrible jokes, tells the same stories again and again and again. You probably heard those stories so many times, but the same thing happened to Albert Einstein. Probably heard Albert Einstein's story as well, but if it's Albert Einstein, the great professor of physics, now in Europe, once he started to become famous, he was invited to go to the United States to talk at universities. And when he went there, of course, not in an aircraft, it was in a boat, a passenger liner. And the universities on the east coast, they arranged everything. They had a chauffeur, a car, and he would go from one university to another to give his lectures on general relativity. The same car, the same chauffeur. Now remember, these were the days before internet and Wikipedia and Facebook. So only a few people had seen a grainy photograph of him on a newspaper. So They didn't know too well what he looked like. That's important. So what happened after about five or six universities, always giving the same lecture, that the chauffeur remarked to Albert between one university and another, he said, "You know, I've listened to so many of your talks, you know, I know them almost off by heart. In fact, I probably could actually deliver the next talk and they probably won't realize it's not you, it's the chauffeur." And Albert Einstein thought, "Yeah, what a good idea, let's give it a try." So they swapped seats and Albert Einstein was in the front with the chauffeur hat on. And when they arrived at the university, something like Princeton or Harvard or somewhere, then, of course, they're waiting for him. They opened the door and the chauffeur walked out, you know, because they thought that he was a great professor. "Oh, welcome to Princeton University, Professor Einstein." And the chauffeur nodded and he went in to have a nice dinner and he made small talk and had some brandy or whatever they did in those days. Well, Albert Einstein, the real professor, just went and had a, you know, nice cheap lunch with the servants. And then it came to the lecture. So they invited the great Albert Einstein, the amazing professor of physics, the amazing person who's broken so much new ground in physics. Please give a round of applause to Professor Einstein from Europe. And of course the chauffeur went up and said, "Bow to everybody, thank you for the applause," and then he gave the lecture. And he'd listened to the lecture so many times. He gave a perfect rendition of the lecture which Albert Einstein used to give on general relativity. And at the end of his talk, he got a standing ovation. And then, there's always one or two people who are suspicious. And there was a lecturer, you know, in the field, in the back somewhere, or in the middle, and he stood up at question time and said, "Can I ask a question, Professor?" And the chauffeur said, "Yeah." And he asked this very deep, complicated question on general relativity, and to see if it really was Einstein or a fraud. And the chauffeur looked at this professor who just asked the question with total disdain. And he said, "Professor, that is such a basic, simple question. I'm sure even my chauffeur in the back could answer that one." And the chauffeur stood up and answered it. And I can relate to that story. Okay. What is your comment on "there is still tomorrow"? You don't get stillness tomorrow, there is only still now. There's no still tomorrow. Still is now. Doesn't relate to laziness or maybe being not so responsible towards your work. No, it's not still tomorrow. My saying is never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. It's true, isn't it? Yeah, one day it's going to happen. Imagine one day you've got everything packed, your bags, you've got all the house cleaned up, and so you can actually get ready to enjoy the next day free of all your work, and you die tonight. What a waste of time. You're going to be enjoying, meditating, having a nice time, and then just all this, and then you go and die. Oh. You've just got it all nicely sorted out. So that is one of the reasons why, yeah, we do our jobs, but always remember that sometimes that by thinking about tomorrow, we are abandoning today. Where is the future made? Now. Now is the only time you can do anything for your future. So sometimes we worry about tomorrow and we're not paying any attention to the present where your future is being made. "Dear Ajahn, I got a small breakthrough applying your angry monster talk to my itchy woolly sweater. I was kind to the itch and it disappeared 95% within a few minutes. My mind, however, something loudly in the meantime, spoke loudly in the meantime, to just take the easy way out and get rid of the sweater. My question is, when do we know or draw the line to be kind and transform the discomfort, or when to remove oneself from discomfort so as not to be self-harm, e.g. the knee reconstruction that the monk had to endure? It's just sensible. If it's an easy way, take it. Why not? You know, sometimes people ask me, is it possible for lay people to become enlightened? Or should you become a monk or a nun? And it's true, you can. Lay people can become fully enlightened, the whole works. But it's like saying, lay people, you can walk all the way back to Melbourne or Sydney. You can't really get to Singapore, there's a bit of water in the water. Actually, you can swim, I suppose. You can swim. You don't need to take an aircraft to get back to Singapore or to Jakarta. But there are aircraft. Why not take the easy way? You'd be dumb and stupid to walk all the way back to Sydney when there's cheap aircraft going on. So this is like why you have the Sangha. This is the easy way to enlightenment. It was just all set up by the Buddha so that people can become monks and nuns and have the best way. It's called Buddha Air. So why not? So anyway, you've got your angry monster. If there's nothing else to do which works, then try the angry monster. But the best thing to do is actually kick the monster out to begin with. We just want to be happy. Speak for yourself. Why are you just... But, you know that... Does anyone do statistics here? To do... You know it's been proven that 6 out of 7 dwarves are not happy. 6 out of 7 dwarves are not happy. The 7 dwarves? Snow White? Snow White and the 7 dwarves. One of those dwarves is named Happy, yeah. So statistics prove that 6 out of 7 dwarves are not happy. Okay. We just want to be happy, but to what degree should it be so it won't be egotistic? You can't be happy when everyone else is miserable. So, your happiness, my happiness, all work together. If I see you really miserable and really upset, then I get miserable too. The reason is, it's the old elephant story. That was one of the books. It's number 4, I think, in Germany. In the elephant which lost its happiness. I think I mentioned that to you before, the first day, that if an elephant had all these bad guys, you know, just outside the elephant store where it slept the night, and they would just say bad things and talk bad things and plan bad things, until the elephant became bad. He just got the vibes of these bad people. And then they arrested the thieves and they replaced the thieves with these really nice people, the good people, the monks and the nuns, and they talked dumb and they meditated and they chanted and just the nice energy of the Sangha, good people. And the elephant became a good elephant again. So, if you are miserable, you make other people miserable. If you're happy, you make other people happy. There was this lady came to one of my meditation classes, and she told me afterwards, she said, "You just finished work," it was on a Tuesday evening, she'd finished work, and her kid said, "Mummy, you're going to meditation tonight?" "No, I feel tired." "Could come home for work." "Mummy, I think you should go to meditation tonight." "No, I'm just too tired, I just want to rest." "Mummy, go to meditation tonight." A 6-year-old kid or something. "Why, darling?" "Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation." So, you know, if you're miserable, you make other people miserable. If you're happy and peaceful, you make other people happy and peaceful. It does. It's called empathy. It's called mudita. So, you know, when you pick up on other people's happiness, it's called compassion. When you pick up on other people's sadness. So, you know, we do have the empathy together. So that's one of the reasons why the one less miserable person in Hong Kong when you go back. One less troubled person in Indonesia when you go back there. It's a great blessing for everybody. So you can be happy and peaceful. So it's a wonderful thing. So it's not just about your happiness. It's about our happiness. It's our problem, our solution, our happiness. We enjoy it together. So, I went through those questions pretty quickly, but still it's 8:45, so I think it's okay now. So, first of all, we're going to do a loving kindness. Yeah? Hi? Yes? Hello? Yeah, what can we do?
One question being the last lecture of this retreat.
Yes?
I happened to meet four incredible people.
Yes?
In this retreat. Ajahn Bom.
Yeah.
And two nuns.
Yeah.
I didn't need to observe them.
Oh, that's over in.
And Ajahn Sujata.
Yes, very good.
Incredibly talented people.
Oh, yeah. Are you trying to headhunt?
Of course. That's what I do. For my living. Ajahn Sujata is more related to what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So, and I met the other man who took us for a tour.
Ah, yes.
She's a pharmaceutical IT. She's extremely intelligent.
Oh, yeah.
And you got knowledge of a wide variety of things.
Yeah.
My question is, what motivates you to become a monk?
What motivates what? Jokes apart. Well motivated. Look, seriously, over at Cambridge, you know, the system over there was you had colleges, and every college, you know, had their professors, so you socialized with them. So you actually did have dinner with Nobel laureates. And then I was just so disappointed that these were people who were brilliant in their field. But stupid in life. They were having problems with their marriage. They were getting problems with, you know, anxiety and ego. I remember just these couple of, they were just only supervisors. And then they said, they told me, said, in the next room they think they've discovered a new subatomic particle. Now, what do they know? They're just so stupid. They haven't discovered a subatomic particle. It's just so much pride and arrogance. And to me, there was something missing there. So much intelligence, but not put to any good use. And then, you know, you saw someone like an Ajahn Shah, 4 years of school, that's all. And my goodness, he was one of the wisest persons I ever saw. And sometimes you wondered, all the great talents which people have, are they really putting them to good use? And so I fell into monastic life and I loved it. And I think I've been a pretty successful and influential monk. So, very fortunate, found my spot.
That's where my question is. Actually.
Yeah.
We are learning so much from you people, monks and nuns, and you are giving us so much away. That the purpose, or is that something you wanted to be?
Not at all. It just happens. No, sometimes it just happens. You don't plan anything. I did do a little bit of planning because I was number two monk here. And that was a perfect position. So, you know, I always say it's the front car in the convoy gets all the bugs on the windscreen. And if you're tailgating, you know, you slipstream, it's much easier. So the front guy, he was getting all the bumps on the windscreen, I was just enjoying myself, and then he went and fell in love and disrobed. So that was like my plan. But, you know, it happened, so what can you do? So then he just started, and I made a resolution, it was teaching. Can I teach? And you know that there was one of the disciples from the Singapore Buddhist group, Angie Monksfield, you know them. She came and stayed here sometime, and so she went in the library and got the earliest talk by Ajahn Brahm. It was on an old cassette tape. She wanted to find out, so long ago, did Ajahn Brahm really give inspiring talks then? And she listened to it, and she came back to see me and said, Ajahn Brahm, I found this talk you gave when you first came to Perth. It was terrible. It was right, people would walk out. you learn. So that's what you do. You try your best and see what happens. If you become a nice teacher, great. If you don't become a great teacher, great. You can have a peaceful life. So either way, you're not sort of demanding that you're going to be a good teacher or a bad teacher. Just see what happens. So it's wonderful, easy going life. There's always a place for you, no matter if you're a good teacher or a bad teacher, whatever happens. And sometimes there are great monks who just sit there and they're just so peaceful just looking at them. They don't need to open their mouth. Or just a nice little smile. And that makes other people's day. And same with the nuns. I don't know how many nuns you talk to, but when you saw them, they're inspiring. They don't need to speak, just who they are. So there's many, many things we can do. And so this is one of the reasons why you become a monk. You don't really realize why you're becoming a monk. But then once you sort of get into it, it actually feels really good. And the nice thing about being a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun in this tradition, you can leave any time. And there's no shame on you. Say, bad monk, bad nun, you didn't make it. It's always, well done, you made it for a whole week. Congratulations. It's not a hard thing to do. 2 weeks is wonderful. So that sort of positive, not criticizing and not struggling and not forcing the issue. That was a very beautiful thing which we learned. So that was a little thing which and I not just became a monk but stayed as a monk. Excellent. Okay, so now it'd be good. Any other question before we do the... Okay, let's do a loving kindness, maybe 20 minutes or so. So first of all, some of you, including me, have been sitting down. So we've got to practice what we preach. If it's loving kindness, get up and have a stretch. And if you want to go creak, creak. Some? Well, you can soft. Get some ambience. Make it romantic. Okay. Whoa, a bit dark. Okay. There you go. So when you had a bit of a stretch and a scratch, then you can go and sit down. So I'll do this guided loving kindness meditation, and when it's finished at the end, I'll give the final blessing. So please keep your eyes closed until the blessing is finished. So you close your eyes. It's a kindness meditation, so please be kind to your body first of all. With your eyes closed, you have more space in your brain to be aware of the physical feelings. So it's only about 20 minutes, 25 minute meditation. So just get your mind, your body nice and comfortable. Make sure your legs are not sort of squashed against each other so they're going to cut off the circulation or make an ache. If you are sitting on a chair, you can put your feet further out or tuck them in, spread out the knees, whatever is comfortable for you right now. And to do that, you have to be aware of your feelings, sensations in your legs, and really care for them. And then you can move your attention up to your butt. These buttocks are pressed against the chair. Sometimes they get sore because you don't look after them, put them in the best position to begin with. So get your butt just really nice. And then your back. I still like this. I like to sort of stretch the back when I've got the butt all nice and settled. Stretch it and get all these endorphins. It's why dogs and cats do stretches. Beautiful. Even kangaroos do as well. And then I relax the back. I'm really aware of it. Feel it. Understand it. Get to know it. And I experiment. Move it this way, move it that way. Maybe move it back, lean against the chair, move it forward, even leaning to the left or the right. All the time I'm checking, is this more comfortable? Until I find the optimum comfort position for my own back. You see that again with animals. Like you see a dog, when it goes to sleep at night, it just circles around. You know, until it circles and then it finds a nice position, the best position for it. And just get your back nice and comfy. Don't follow the books or the advice of monks like me. Feel it for yourself. Get to know. Mindfulness and kindness in your own wisdom. How does your back feel right now? What's the best position for it? And then you can look at your hands, make sure your hands are comfortable. They can be on your knee, they can be in your lap, you can do whatever you want with them, as long as they're comfortable. And I relax my shoulders and just moving them in circles, just so they get nice and comfortable. So there can be no tightness or tension there. And I loosen them. Like I let go of all the tension, loosening the strings so there's nothing being held tight. Then my neck, moving my head on my neck just to make it comfortable. Any irritation in the throat, just what makes it easy? What lessens the irritation so you don't need to cough? You move up to your head. Got a little bit of sinus irritation. Not much, it's pretty easy, just leave it alone. But I'm especially aware of the muscles around my eyes and the muscles around my mouth. Because if there's any anxiety or fear or anger or whatever, that's where it manifests. So I can just relax the muscles around my mouth and around my eyes. I can feel it. Feel them just opening up, loosening, as if things which were pulled apart are now let go so they can be at ease. And now I am just being aware of my whole body. I've paid attention to it, cared for it, just for 5 minutes. My body is responding. Thank you. Feels much easier, more relaxed than it was at first. This mindfulness and kindness works. And any time during the meditation, if it's a tight spot, I'm going to focus on it and just ease it, relax it. I'm a good friend to my body, not a control freak. And then I look at my peaceometer. Done a lot of work today. How peaceful are you, mind? How can I get you to be a little bit more peaceful? I always notice if any perception of time, future, past, that makes me tense. Natural, it's just what happens. If I stay in this present moment and just trust things will work out, in this moment, respecting this moment, being kind to it, and I find that the tightness vanishes, my peaceometer shows more and more peace. And I also notice I'm just being in this moment. Past and future, now is where my future is made. Just being here. Now we do the loving kindness. To do the loving kindness, we use a little bit of inner commentary, which I will supply for you. This understanding that loving kindness, compassion, is similar to a fire. To light a fire, you have to use a match and something which very easily takes a flame, like dry paper. And then you put on bigger pieces of wood, the kindling or the twigs. And as the fire becomes established, you put on bigger and bigger pieces of wood. And when you've got a big hot blaze going, then you can put on the big wet sappy logs. And there's enough heat in the fire to burn out the moisture, so the big sappy logs also take the fire, in this case of loving kindness. So, to start the fire of loving kindness, if you can imagine a being, an imaginary being, not a real one, I usually choose a little kitten. I just like kittens. Abandoned, lonely, hungry. It could imagine a puppy. It could imagine a child. It could imagine a rabbit, a bunny, or whatever. Or could you imagine just like one lady who didn't like pets or babies. She imagined a little pot plant. A little pot plant in the balcony of her apartment in Sydney, which she was nurturing. Whatever you can imagine is vulnerable, which really needs your protection and your love and your nurturing. Well, I say kitten, you can use anything else which you feel is something you really do need to nurture. So I look at my little kitten, abandoned, hungry, frightened. It's like every time it's come out and trusted somebody, it's been let down and hurt. Frightened. But my little kitten is hiding in a dark corner of the world, afraid, cold, wanting a friend, but too afraid to try to find one. It's been hurt too many times. And I walk past, see these eyes in the blackness. Kitten's eyes, and it's frightened, doesn't trust me, so I look into its eyes with my eyes, and I spread all the kindness and love and reassurance which I can muster up, concentrate into my eyes and just spray them. Beautiful loving kindness of trust. I will never hurt you, little kitten. We all need a friend, someone to care for us, may I be your friend to nurture you. Life may have been so hard to you, so cruel. I won't. And as I develop what is loving kindness, care, compassion, love towards my imaginary little kid, you see its eyes change. It's actually responding. It's saying that maybe this old monk, maybe he's the one who will care for me. Should I trust him? And I extend my hand slowly, so as not to frighten this terrified little being. And as I extend it, it draws back. I look into its eyes. Little kitten, I will never ever harm you. I want to care for you, to protect you, to warm you, to feed you. We all need people to look after us and care for us. Life can be so hard and cold and sharp. And it's worse without someone. So I put my hand even further. And that little kitten lets me touch her. And I feel the fur. Not like an ordinary kitten's fur, it's dirty. I can feel the scabs of blood on her. All skin and bone. This poor little kitten has had such a hard introduction to this life. And still keeping my eye contact and just focusing all this loving kindness, reassurance, feeling of safety, love through my eyes into her eyes. I gently pick her up. The amazing thing is she lets me. She trusts. We can see that she's ready to jump away. And the first bit of fear, I have to be so careful as I bring her right towards my chest, my robe. I hold her so gently. Dear little kitten, the door of my heart is open to you. I will never harm you, but I will protect you, feed you, give you a warm, safe place to sleep at night, to heal, help you heal those wounds. Just watch you, just put on some muscle around those poor bones, and to make you fit and joyful and happy and just jumping up around and being a naughty little kitten like every other kitten is. To watch you grow into a cat and always know I'll be your friend. You not controlling, you go out and do cat stuff. I'll always be there for you when you come back with a nice bowl of milk or whatever else I can find for you. Dear little kitten, I care for you. And as I'm holding it on my chest, don't you imagine a little cat? It's like it's real now. I feel the warmth of my chest begin to tingle. I spread that warmth, that tingling, loving kindness into the body. Then from the little paws down to its tail, up to its ears and its whiskers, all through that little kitten, my love is warming it, giving it perhaps the first feeling of safety since it was taken away from its mother. Even though it's hungry, what it wants now is safety and warmth and love. The food will come shortly, little kitten. And I hug it so gently, warm it, and I feel this beautiful golden rays, light of loving kindness coming from my chest, through my skin, through my little kitten's fur, and into its body. It's loving kindness, compassion. It goes all through its body, healing it, softening it, and I can feel it, just the hard fear in its body, making it rigid. It's now softened. It's like a ball of just this soft, fur and fluff like it should be. Little kitten, the door of my heart will always be open. I care for you, let me care. Can I even imagine hearing this little kitten begin to purr? With his eyes closing, trust me implicitly. He's purring. He's found a friend, a protector. And when I develop these feelings of loving kindness, compassion, care, spreading to this little kitten, the feeling in my chest gets tingling, I can really feel it, it's strong. I've started the fire of loving kindness and care. So now I imagine another being, a real person, someone who I'm very close to, a person who is maybe your closest friend in this life. It could be your partner, it could be a child, it could be your father or mother, whoever. Imagine them as just right in front of you. They are like the little kitten. They may be old and strong and wealthy, but they need kindness and love as well. Otherwise, they just get hurt so easily. So imagine that being you're so close to in this world. Imagine it, my dear friend, partner, lover, family member. I care for you. I truly care. I want you to be happy, to be healthy, to be free of all this worry and anxiety, to see you smile, like purr, like that little kitten. And you imagine all this loving kindness coming from your chest, these golden rays of light going right through your chest into them, bathing them, drenching them from their head to their toe, to the tips of their fingers, to the edge of their ears, going right into them, reassuring them. And they can't resist accepting this incredible, powerful loving kindness. Sincere care. I'd never want to harm you. I'm just here to be of service. It's not about you, it's not about me, it will always be about us. I care. Truly. And I even imagine this point, invisible arms coming out from my chest. Going around them, round the back, pulling them towards me, hugging them, reassuring them, giving every part of my body and mind over to kindness and care and compassion and love and forgiveness and acceptance and friendship. As you, so me. As me, so you. I care for you. You feel the power of loving kindness. It's very blissful, pleasant, delightful. You just let yourself go with that kindness given to somebody else. You can feel them just relax and melt under your loving kindness. And then, without opening your eyes, imagine all the people in this room, all in this hall, who have spent the last 8 or 9 days with you. Some people you haven't known before. Some people you've been passing in the dining room. They are just so like you. They get hurt. They're sensitive. They get bruised physically, but also in their mind. And all they need is this tiny bit of kindness, acceptance, love, to know they belong, that people care for them. So you spread this beautiful loving kindness, this fire we've been building up in our heart, through your chest, to every person in this room, including me, everyone. May all the beings in this room, meditators, not judging, not comparing, all beings on the path, you all belong here. You're all cared for. You're not rejected. You belong. We care for you. Please open your heart to receive our love. Very dangerous and scary thing to receive love from somebody else. But it's the only way. Otherwise we're just a cold, alone, ice blocks, living in concrete bunkers which we build around our hearts, lest we won't get hurt. You don't get hurt in a concrete bunker. You're not alive. So you receive the loving kindness of all these people in this room. People you probably don't know. But still they care. And you care for them. There's this golden glow, this light just goes right into this room, to this low corner of this room, which is a pervaded grow this golden light of forgiveness and love and unconditional loving kindness. No strings attached. I don't want anything out of you. I just want to have the privilege of giving the kindness and love like I gave to my little kitten. And you're receiving some of that as well. How does it feel? Until the loving kindness, the energy is too strong to hold in this room. It goes out to this compound, to the cooks, to the cleaners, to the monks on the other side of the road, over to the caretakers, up to the prison where there's people who are suffering from silly, stupid things they've done which has hurt others. Care for everyone. They're just like those little kittens, just scratching out of fear, self-protection, stupidity, I don't know why, revenge. But right now we care for everybody. This golden light spreads all the way up to Perth, down to Mandurah and Bunbury, the whole of this seaboard of Western Australia. Because here there are husbands and wives arguing, kids feeling not heard, parents alone, people in hospitals fighting for their life. May all beings in the great city of Perth receive my love. Unconditional, no strings attached. I care for every one of you. How can you do that? Just like the sun, it shines on all beings without discrimination or choosing. That's what real love is. Whoever comes into its rays receives the kindness. And spread it even further. Many of you come from distant places, from Melbourne and Sydney, Zealand, over to Indonesia. There's so many friends over there. Hong Kong, Thailand and Singapore. I was never born in that part of the world because so many people I love and care for, and they love and care for me. May all beings in that part of the world be free and happy as a gift for me. Freely given, no strings attached, asking nothing back in return. Just the joy, the privilege of giving that love. As you spread it even further over to Thailand and Burma and China and India, all your relations there, some maybe you don't even know. It doesn't matter, you give it to all beings, and over to the Middle East, Africa, Europe, the United States, all beings, South America, Canada, may all beings on this great planet Earth, not just human beings, animals and birds as well, and fish and whales, all beings, in this moment, may you just feel that we care for you. You may be afraid, may be hurting. May just that knowledge, that little bit of kindness, take the edge away from your pain. May this whole world, including the environment, the rivers, the trees and the forests, may the whole world receive our love. May they benefit and be healthier, even more beautiful. May this whole world be blanketed by our loving kindness. Now, there's one person you missed out. Imagine now you're standing in front of a full-length mirror of yourself. This person you've grown up with, you've gone through so many trials and pain and joys and happiness as well. Amazing, the individual stories of a human being. You've survived, you've grown, you've loved, you've cried, you've had sleepless nights not knowing how you can survive. And you do. This little person you've known for such a long time. Looking at that person, tell them I care for you. I truly care for this person who bears my name, me. This loving kindness from your own heart goes right inside of you, around you, healing, freeing, non-judging, learning how to find peace with yourself as you are, not changing, not growing, not improving. It's like mothers love their children just as they are. The door of my heart, say to yourself, is fully open to yourself. No strings, no condition. Just come in. You pushed yourself outside, rejected your own self, this being you can never escape from. Say, I care for me. I forgive me any faults. I love me. With sincerity and peace and wisdom. It's like you're free of this prison of self-criticism, self-doubt, self-harm, coming into this beautiful light, this warm golden glow, which I gave my little kitten, now giving me. You give it to yourself. I care. How does that feel? Please keep your eyes closed as I give the final blessing. Sabha Vairamati. There we go. So just before you go, I have an announcement to make. Many of you have been saying in your retreat, it's been going so well, we've decided to carry on. So tomorrow, have a nice night. Tomorrow, meditate here. There won't be any chanting. Get your breakfast, and then just have a nice wander over to Bodhinyana. Those who need a lift, I'm sure there'll be cars to come over. And those of you travelling back tomorrow, your homelands, your countries, your friends, your family, the people are really missing you. Just go back and give a lot of kindness and love and peace to them. So may they be happy volunteers. Okay, there we go. All done. Very good. Thank you.